to today's Quantum Foundations seminar. Today we have Chris Ferry, who is currently at the University of New Mexico. Previously he did his PhD here in Waterloo at IQC as a student of Joseph Johnson. Today he's going to talk about classical post-selection and Stokes paradoxes. By a curious twist of fate, Yaki Aharonov is also here at Perimeter Institute. Since this work addresses that work, I'm going to ask Yaki to after Chris. after Chris has finished, we'll ask Yaki to come and talk to us for 10 or 15 minutes just to put the other side. So we're going to have, a very interesting discussion here and learn something.
I don't think
we are.
We're in a different weight class, I think.
So I think we'll have a very interesting session today. So without further ado, please go ahead.
Thank you, Lucien. So the title in the abstract posted online was intentionally provocative, and I think it did its job. But if you're here for fireworks, I think you'll be somewhat disappointed. I'm going to try not to say anything too controversial. So what I'm going to talk about is some ideas in quantum mechanics, in particular this post-selection. Should mute. There's some other people kind of Skyping in, and apparently they don't want to be quiet. So I can hear them up here, but you probably can't. There we go. So the idea is that we all sort of have heard and perhaps accepted that quantum mechanics is weird and mysterious in some way. There's certainly philosophical and metaphysical reasons for trying to figure out what exactly is so weird about quantum mechanics. Presumably, if you're a reductionist, everything in this room and in this world behaves the laws of quantum mechanics. And somehow classical physics is emergent. But perhaps there's something in quantum mechanics that when we try to sort of extrapolate it up to the macroscopic realm, it just defies all sort of classical intuition. And so this has become a practical concern, since this is essentially what a quantum computer would do. It would somehow be some macroscopic manifestation of something that is truly quantum. So what is that? And if we knew what it was now, would that help us develop quantum technologies? So it's not only a metaphysical question, it's a practical question. And one approach to trying to identify it is just looking at classical theory and starting to rule out things that we propose is uniquely quantum. And by a process of elimination, maybe the kernel that's left over will be that quantum je ne sais quoi that will help us build this quantum computer. So I want to argue that there's just this phenomenon of anomalous weak values, which is claimed to not be present in classical theory. So perhaps it's something uniquely quantum is actually present in quantum theory. So I want to demonstrate that for you in a very simple model. And that's joint work with Josh Coombs, who's a postdoc here. So after I leave, you can go harass him about it.
Sorry, did you say it's actually present in classical theories?
In classical theories, yeah. And then there's a sort of similar phenomenon called protective measurement, which I want to argue is also present in classical theory. And that's ongoing work with Josh and Matt Leifer, who's also here. And perhaps we'll drag Matt Fusey into it as well. And so I'm just going to touch on that, kind of give you the flavor of the idea, but it's ongoing work. So the lecture that you saw just an hour ago is actually almost perfect context for this. So you mean you've already seen a lot of these calculations, but I'll just overview it for you and then put a different spin on it. I want to tell you about weak values and protective measurement. The starting point is, you know, what we usually think of it as measurement, so the textbook description. And so I just took this from a textbook. Some call it, the postulate, the one that sort of uniquely identifies quantum mechanics. And it's the one about measurement, depending on what textbook you read, it'll come in a different order. Axiom, what do you call it? Axiom 4, axiom 3, something like that, whatever. So we have Hermitian operators. That comes before, the Hilbert space, Hermitian operators. Some postulate says there is a physical observable associated with every Hermitian operator. So in the measurement of this observable, the only values that will ever be observed are the eigenvalues. I've just written down the eigenvalue equation. So A ket is an eigenvector of A, and A is its eigenvalue. So the eigenvectors are labeled by the eigenvalues. And if, after we've done this measurement, value A is observed, then regardless of what the initial quantum state was, the post-measurement state collapses to A. Okay? And so there's perhaps a measurement paradox in there, but I don't want to talk about that. But how would you actually do such a measurement? So to measure this observable A, as you saw in the lecture 2 hours ago, or if you weren't at that lecture, hopefully you've already seen it before. I'll just overview it. I have a Hamiltonian which couples A to a canonical observable on some continuous variable system. So meter system, I'm coupling A to the generator of position. Okay, and I want to take some arbitrary initial state of the system and meter and evolve it under this generator, Hamiltonian evolution. So I'm applying the unitary on the left of these states, and all I've done here, sort of the most beautiful thing about Dirac notation is, this resolution of the identity. You just take them and you drop them in everywhere and things simplify. So I've taken a resolution of the identity, in particular the vectors in the spectral decomposition of A, the operator A, and I've applied it to from the left over here, right? And there's one of the first properties you learn is that if A has some spectral decomposition, then some function of A is just applied to the spectrum of the observable. In particular, I have this exponential function here. So I pick up the eigenvalues come into the function, the exponential function. So that's all that's happened here. Okay. Now we want to understand the transition to some other state, in particular eigenstates of this operator here. So, I sandwich that between the unitary. This is orthogonal to this state. So the sum goes away and all the A's are replaced by A primes. Q acting on psi is the wave function of my meter. And momentum is the generator of translations. So what I get is I get a kick in position by that value. And so the picture is, you have this meter and you start in sort of a very sharp initial meter wave function. And you can maybe just kind of think of it like a delta function almost. And the only values that it can be kicked to will be the eigenvalues. And if the state was not an eigenvalue, then what I get is also some probability for that particular transition of the meter happening. Okay. Now, how about weak measurement? So essentially, the only difference is just take an initial meter position that's very broad. I mean, the cartoon doesn't even do it justice because I want to sort of do a Taylor expansion. So just imagine something even flatter than this for any particular possible value. So I have the same equation. Now I continue to measure the position of the meter, but now I just take some arbitrary final state of the system, and I just apply it here. But you see that now you have the sum and things aren't simplifying. So one trick to sort of simplify things is to assume that the function is well approximated by its first order Taylor series, and this will be true if it's extremely broad. Okay, so I have that equation, and I'm going to insert that first order Taylor series here. So the first term was just phi, and the second term had a times the derivative of phi. And since the first term didn't depend on a anymore, I have a sum over the outer product of a. That's just the resolution of the identity. The second term had a, right? The second term had an a only. And so a times this outer product and the sum just gives me back the operator. And what I'm doing in this step is I'm factoring out that this inner product out front. And then I'm going to sort of invert that Taylor series, right? So this is the Taylor series, the first order Taylor series of this function about this value. Okay? So it looks a lot like before, except now it appears that the meter wave function has been shifted not by an eigenvalue of A, but by this value here. Okay? Provided that this was the state that was observed. This is called the weak value. I'm led to believe there's some people in the audience have heard about this. But you see that if phi and psi are nearly orthogonal, then this denominator is extremely big. And if it's also not an eigenvector of A, then they're not going to cancel. And you can get an arbitrarily large number here. In this talk, you can see that these are amplitudes, so they could also be complex. But they don't need to be complex to have this phenomenon of going outside the eigenvalue range of A. So let's just assume whenever you see an amplitude, it's real. I can always choose states such that that will happen. And it's sufficient to have some sort of paradox or some sort of situation that's not reconcilable, apparently, with the conventional wisdom. Okay, so everything is real. Okay, so that's the review. The first thing I want to do is I want to reformulate this weak value into a situation that there's no meter. So I'm going to do sort of I'm a quantum information theorist, so what I'm going to do is I'm just going to work with sort of the generalized theory of quantum mechanics where the meter is always traced out, okay? So let's call this meterless weak values. This is done in far more generality by various people. Howard Wiseman maybe even did it before this paper, but this paper lays it out nicely. So is there anyone not familiar with the POVM formalism? Excellent. Okay, so let's consider only a qubit, and remember again, everything's going to be real, so I can just draw the plane, any sort of plane in qubit space, and the POVM will be a two-outcome POVM. With values plus and minus one. Lambda will be some parameter. And these are the POVM elements. So there's two of them. You can see that they sum to one. This will be a fact that we'll use a lot in a few calculations that I'll do. If I'm summing over something that has an S, S goes from plus one to minus one, so that term is always going to get canceled in any sum. So these two sum to one, it's a valid POVM. Let's check that when lambda is zero, I just have some trivial measurement. So I get no information about the state, and the post-measurement state just remains the same. So that sort of appeals to our intuition that the sort of weaker the measurement, the less information we get, yet the less disturbance we put on this system. If lambda equals one, then this thing will just turn out to be one of the eigenvectors, or the projector onto one of the eigenvectors of sigma z. Does everyone see that? So the question is, what happens in between? So this is as weak as you can get. This is as strong as you can get. It just turns into the standard projective measurement of sigma z. But something in between is a weak measurement of sigma z. OK? You can actually derive this by taking that other picture with the meter and tracing it out and finding out what the Krauss operators are. And you'll get something that to first order is equivalent to this. I'll do something simpler and just take as my Krauss operators the square root of these POVM elements. OK, so to first order in a Taylor series of the square root, you get the usual sort of usual Taylor series expansion that you would expect, except with operators. OK? So this is the picture you should have in your mind. I have some state. It's defined by some angle, theta. I do a weak measurement of sigma z, and the state gets updated depending on what outcome I get. If I get plus, it gets a little bit closer to sigma z. If I get minus, it gets a little bit closer, or it gets a little bit closer to the plus eigenstate. And if I get minus, it gets a little bit closer to the minus eigenstate. Now, remember, in the weak measurement, I had to actually do this extra thing, which was the post-selection. So after doing the weak measurement, I'm now going to do a strong projective measurement defined by some vector. So the measurement will be, you know, any observable that has these two vectors as its eigenstates. Okay? Then sort of the conceptual question we want to ask is, given I got this outcome and I started with this state, what was the conditional expectation of the weak measurement in between? So pre-select on psi, post-select on phi, what is the expectation value of the weak measurement observable? Okay, so let's do that calculation. So this definition of expectation value just means this is a random variable. This is the distribution of that random variable. So I just take the random variable and I multiply it by its distribution and I sum over all the outcomes. I don't know what this probability is, so I use Bayes' rule. Okay. The probability of getting phi, the final measurement outcome, given I started in psi and I got one of the outcomes of the weak measurement, that's easy to do. First, I apply Leuter's rule, the state update rule after the weak measurement. So I apply the Krauss operator to the state and I normalize. And then the probability, that's a new state, right? That's the new state. And then the probability to get outcome phi is just the inner product between those two states. So I just plug in that first order approximation. And then this thing is squared, so I don't need to worry about this. So that those two things cancel. And then, you know, there's some steps, and you see because I square it, there's going to be some other orders of approximation. But essentially what I want you to believe is that I have phi an identity in psi, but that's multiplied by s. So anything that's multiplied by just s is going to cancel out in this sum. But I have s and s of the lambda order lambda terms. So that's going to be s squared. So those two terms are going to double. And you can see with the twos lying around, you can believe that those are going to cancel out. And I'm going to get, and of course, down here, I'm going to have something that's proportional to this inner product. So I haven't gone through the next like three steps, but you can believe me that the expectation value of S in the distribution, this conditional distribution with pre and post selection, is proportional to the weak value, and the constant of proportionality is this weakness parameter. Okay? So how do we get the weak value? Remember, we have all those order lambda squared to higher order terms, so we want to get rid of those. So we divide S by lambda, and then we take the limit as lambda goes to zero, limit of, you know, weakening the measurement, and that conditional expectation will give you the weak value. Okay, so it's nice, finite dimensional, there's no meter, nice and operational if you can implement this POVM. Okay? Is there any questions about that?
I was a little bit confused a few slides ago about whether you were doing a Taylor expansion. You don't have to switch, but just when you have this weak value that is large, are you ever actually doing a Taylor expansion in that variable? Because it looked in one slide kind of like you were.
No.
Okay. All right. So I guess I just misinterpreted. Right.
In the meter picture?
Yeah, exactly. So I wasn't sure if that was just like something that wasn't entirely clear about.
Yeah. Okay. So I mean, there's some technicality. I mean, I said you can make it arbitrarily large, but
yeah,
you know, in reality, you have to think about the fact that if you have a Gaussian, you know, this approximation isn't going to be good, you know, when it's arbitrarily large. So there's things you have to worry about.
Okay. Okay, but they're considered properly, so I could look at that
later. Yeah, there's papers that do this that, you know, put bounds on how big in practice you could make this thing. Okay, so here's just an example. This is an arbitrarily, you know, this is true for any theta, but to get a large value, this is the picture you want to imagine in your head. The weak measurements in Z, so what I want is a pre and post selected state that's not an eigenstate of Z, so something far away would be nice. So how about something that's close to eigenstates of X? And then the post selected state is nearly orthogonal to the pre-selected state, okay? Remember, orthogonal points are antipodal in the Bloch sphere. And this is the calculation for any theta, but you can see that when theta is close to pi over 2, you get something that's close to 0 down here, and you get this large weak value. Now I'm going to tell you how to do this classically. And immediately you just say, well, that's impossible, because you know, if it was a classical distribution, say a coin, then that means that would be equivalent to everything being in the same basis in quantum mechanics, right? It would be, you know, everything's diagonal in some basis, and the basis we're doing the weak measurement is Z. And if, you know, if, well, you can see from here, if theta is zero, then the weak value is one. So there's no way I'm going to get an anomalously weak value. But how about, you know, if after I do the weak measurement in Z, there's some manually put in disturbance, some quantum channel, some bit flip channel that potentially flips the bit and acts as disturbance. So it's simulating sort of the disturbance that would come in from the fact that I'm, you know, this measurement here doesn't commute with this one here. So that's sort of the intuition. But I'm just going to phrase it in a really simple classical way. But note that I could always just map it back to the quantum mechanical case where everything is happening in the same basis. So classical weak values, it's in this archive paper here. So let's phrase it as a simple game. I'm going to use the same sort of symbols, just so that it kind of looks the same. But now, psi, phi, and s are all outcomes of a coin toss at different times in this protocol. Okay, so the protocol is Alice tosses a coin. It has some outcome psi. She's going to pre-select on these. Okay, so she tosses a coin. It's psi. It's either 1 or minus 1, whether it's heads or tails. Passes it to Bob. Bob reports S with this probability. You can think of it as a weak measurement. Maybe you just kind of show it to him like this. He doesn't really know. Or he's a liar. So there's some probability for him to lie about what the result was. Bob returns the coin to Alice, but before returning it to him, there's some probability for him to flip it. This probability has to depend on what the outcome was. And I've written it this way. You'll see on the next slide that I've just made this choice so that things simplify later on. It looks messy, but you know, I've written it this way so that the expressions at the end are much simpler. But what I'll show is that any disturbance whatsoever, no matter how small, results in an anomalous weak value. So this is the parameter that Bob potentially flips the coin. So we called Bob the lambda liar delta deceiver. So he lies with he lies with a probability that's proportional to something like 1/2 1 plus lambda. And it turns out that he will flip the coin with probability 1 minus delta, unconditioned on the outcome. Conditioned on the outcome, this is the probability that he flips it with. OK, and then Alice just looks at the coin after she gets it back and records the outcome. And we have this big data set, and we prune it by pre-selecting and post-selecting on psi and phi. In particular, let's pre-select on heads and post-select on tails. Remember, this is the weak value, right? There's some random variable. I renormalize it by this weakness parameter, and I take the expectation value. You know, it could be anything. Maybe it's a qubit. I don't know. This calculation is always done the same. It's the random variable times this probability distribution. That probability distribution can come from my example just now. It can come from a quantum mechanical example. It doesn't matter. This is the laws of probability, which apparently I just made up the number 1749. Because if you Google probability in 1749, apparently this talk is the first hit. But the point is, probability is old. So again, I use Bayes' rule. Okay, so this probability before was, I apply the Krauss operator to get the new state, and then I take the inner product with the final post-selected state. Now, it's the probability of psi, which is pre-selected on 1. So this was the probability. So that's one. This term is identical to this term. Okay, that's what you see here, right? So Bob receives heads, reports his outcome. It could be plus or minus 1. And the probability that Alice sees minus 1 is exactly the probability that he flips it, right? He received heads, he got S. So the conditional probability of seeing tails now is the probability that he flips the coin. Okay, so that's there. This term doesn't depend on S, so it comes out. Lambda doesn't depend on S, it comes out. The probability of S given psi is just that weak measurement probability. Right, so it looks almost like the POVM elements that I was showing you before, right? Now you can see right away why I chose this form, because that term is going to cancel with that term. Okay, so those go away. I have S multiplying this term and this term, So those go away because I get a term that's multiplied by plus one and a term that's multiplied by minus one. I add them together, they cancel. The only term that survives is the s squared term, which is just multiplied by lambda. And so I have two of them, but I have a half here. So lambdas cancel, I get one over this probability. Okay, what is that probability? So it's a similar calculation. All I've done is use the rules of probability theory. So I've just, to calculate that probability, I just marginalize over S. I've just used the product rule to get to this point, and we've already done a calculation similar to this, right? So this cancels with that. There's no S out front here. So now it's this term that goes away, and one minus delta survives, right? And I have two of them, but there's a half, so that's where I get one minus delta. So this is the weak value, the classical weak value defined in the exact same way as quantum mechanics, and I get 1 over 1 minus delta. Delta is a number that goes between 0 and 1, so in fact, any value whatsoever results in an anomalous weak value. Okay? The closer it is to 1, obviously, the bigger it will be. In fact, if this is a coin toss and say delta, you know, the probability that he flips it, which will be 1 minus delta, as I just showed, is 1%, then the weak value, which you might want to say is the outcome, the expected value of the intermediate measurement that Bob makes, is 100. And that's what we titled our paper. As a kind of little tongue-in-cheek joke. Okay. So that's the end of classical weak values. Now I'm going to just talk briefly about a similar phenomenon called protective measurement.
I have a question for you.
Sure.
So, I mean, I was just wondering if the fact that you need to include a disturbance as part of the measurement process to get this result, does that share any kind of conceptual foundation with, you know, in the epistemic program to account for quantum phenomena, you need to impose a disturbance with the measurement process. Is that just a separate disturbance issue, or is there some connection there?
I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I'd like to know the answer, but I think a similar question, I think, is currently being investigated. Would that be fair to say? This idea of disturbance and these epistemic restrictions, contextuality, science, physics.
Not an assumption, but a consequence. The only way to maintain the restriction on how much you know is
if you force
one variable, imply disturbance to
right.
be
some conjugate yeah.
variable.
So,
and in those contexts, like Matt Liefer and I wrote a paper about the strong pre and post selection results and how measurement disturbance in a hidden variable theory can generate similar sorts of phenomenology there.
Yeah, there's certainly, it seems like there's a connection, but I don't think it's been articulated yet. And it's worth investigating. Okay, so protective measurement. So same scenario as before. I have this state. I do the weak, you know, this is the probability of getting either up or down in this weak measurement of Z is just proportional to cos theta. That would be the, sort of the bare expectation value in sigma Z, but I've made it weak with that POVM element. This again is the state after you measure, so it gets disturbed. But now imagine that there's this constant damping process, which is measuring in the basis of the original state. So it's happening. It's happening very rapidly. So much on a much faster time scale than I'm doing this weak measurement. So the state gets put back into the original state. But sometimes you'll get a flip. Sometimes you'll get the orthogonal state. And what you can show is that the probability for that happening, which would be sort of catastrophic, you would no longer be able to sort of learn what the state was, comes in at order lambda squared. But the probability of getting S, it comes in at order lambda. So you might expect that, you know, with you could maintain some level of information about the system, but by pushing this probability down arbitrarily by making the measurement weaker. If this was some sort of continuous process, then making sure that it happens on a time scale that is more rapid than you're doing the measurement. So there's sort of two different approaches to this protective measurement. There's this Zeno-like approach where I'm doing this Zeno effect. And then there's another approach, which I'm not going to tell you about, but you should be aware of, is where you imagine that you have some very strong system Hamiltonian, and it starts in one of its eigenstates, and there's some large gap to the next eigenstate. And so the probability of going to that next eigenstate, when I disturb the state a little bit, you can push arbitrarily small by making your adiabatic evolutions sufficiently long enough, or by adjusting the gap. So I'm going to tell you how you might expect this to go in this Zeno version, and then its ongoing work to sort of formalize this into a physical model. But the point is that to this order, the state doesn't get disturbed because I'm projecting it back into the original state. And it didn't really matter that I was doing Z. So I could do Z, and after I'm done, the state's, I'm sufficiently happy with my estimate of Z, I'll switch over to Y, and then I'll switch over to X. And then I've learned, I've learned the expectation value of Z, X, and Y, and then I know the state. And the state hasn't been disturbed in the entire process. So there's arguments to suggest that this is all one physical system that's going by, and all these measurements are happening, and this damping process is happening. So I've learned, apparently, a property of a single system. So perhaps I should ascribe an ontic value to the quantum state rather than an epistemic value, which you would think of if you subscribe to, say, the ensemble interpretation or any sort of operational interpretation of quantum mechanics or Bayesian interpretation. So how might this arise in classical theory? So I want to make it look similar to quantum mechanics. So I'll put this disturbance in again, but it's not necessary. So a coin, the state of a quantum system, you draw in this block sphere. It's the convex set of quantum states. The convex set of states of a coin is just the simplex. And there's only two extreme states, either it's heads or tails, so it's just a line. So before I went -1 to 1, but it doesn't really matter. So 0 tails, 1 heads. I have some unknown bias. How do I determine the bias of a coin? Well, I promise that I have identical coins, and they're not correlated. I pick one up and I flip them, and I flip each one, and then I use statistics to determine what the bias was. But suppose let me just paint a little cartoon for you. Suppose the coin has a magnetic moment, and I flip it. The bias, if I knew the initial conditions of everything, then there's really no bias. I could just use classical mechanics to tell you exactly how it's going to land. So you can think of the bias as uncertainty about the initial conditions. And if the coin has some magnetic moment, and I put some strong magnetic field, but I don't know what direction that field is going in, then I have a bias. I don't know what's going to happen. So I flip it, and there's some disturbance because I'm constantly sort of observing it with some invasive measurement. But it's always sort of trying to go back because it has a magnetic moment and there's this strong magnetic field. So there's this tension between me invasively measuring it and this strong magnetic background field. So I'm measuring and disturbing, you can imagine this sort of in discrete time, how do probabilities biases of coins transform? They transform by some linear map, some Markov evolution. How do I get that to go back to the original one? Well, I can just solve a set of equations. So if the original bias was a fixed point of this Markov transition matrix, then it gets exponentially damped back to that. And I can always find such a matrix for which that is true. Yeah.
I'm not following this analogy very well. But you're saying the uncertainty then would be in the direction of the magnetic field, not in the initial condition of launching the coin?
Exactly. So that's sort of the argument. That
what I'm missing is...
So you shouldn't ascribe the bias, the state of the coin, say, to the physical thing, right? The state of the coin should be ascribed to epistemic knowledge about the damping process, which is restoring it back. That's the argument. Now,
I understand this restoring effect. I mean, the visual in my head is a coin's flipping through the air and it's going to land, and that's the result of the measurement. So, what are the intermediate measurements, like gaining more information about the trajectory, or is that the wrong picture?
Yeah, the task is to come up with a model which was as simple as the weak value example. For this, but I mean so for the moment, try to ignore that example. But in look, and it's clear that this could be done. The task is to come up with some convincing classical model, preferably as simple as possible. So definitely not model a coin with Maxwell's equations. But that's sort of the picture I have in my head. Maybe in a couple hours, I'll convince you after we've had a few beers.
So Chris, your solution, if you zoom in to your T definition.
Oh, I can do that.
Nice. Your solution for A and B depends on psi, right?
I mean, look, so in particular, I can choose, if I choose B to be psi, then I just have this situation where, just swapping out the old disturbed distribution and replacing it with a new coin. And I think that makes it sort of clear that...
What I want to say is this prohibits a Bayesian interpretation of the bias of the coin. Because if the bias of the coin is some individual subjective degrees of belief about it, then you're making the disturbance depend on that bias. So in your example, the bias will have to be something that the disturbance process could depend on physically.
If the coins are identical and you're just saying it, the disturbance is swap it up for a new coin, then that's still subjective, right? Everyone would agree.
The disturbance is not swap it up with a new coin. The disturbance is apply this T transform, which has very particular values of A and B that depend on the initial bias of the coin. That's the disturbance.
No. Oh, when I was talking about disturbance, I meant what happens before this. This is sort of the restoring. This is the restoring thing. The disturbance is kind of arbitrary, not even necessary. But in fact, in this scenario, as you said, psi defines t, right? And so I would say that the bias of the coin only serves to define the damping process, which is happening, which is, it's a preparation procedure, right? And that, to me, brings you back to the sort of usual interpretation of a distribution, which is sort of uncertainty about some preparation procedure.
So T describes the damping procedure.
Yeah.
And it's true that this damping procedure will be protective for only one bias of coin.
Yeah.
So if the bias of the coin were, if it were subjective and two people disagreed about it, then only one of them would describe the damping process as protective.
Well, imagine that the damping process is just someone you give the coin to and they just replace it with a new copy. Then your subjective degrees of belief are about what kinds of coins they're giving you.
Okay.
Again, work in progress.
All right.
So let's bring it to a grand finale. So I told you about classical anomalous weak values. I tried to tell you about the beginnings of classical protective measurement. And then, given this, the question I want to ask, the question I think you should ask yourself is post-election something that, these phenomena that you see in quantum mechanics that are due to post-selection, are they really that surprising or unique?
Are you finished talking about the protective measurement now?
I'm finished.
Because I didn't understand sort of what was the main point. The main point was you could work out the bias of the coin by having a single copy of the coin,
right,
and doing multiple measurements on it rather than having many independent copies,
right,
of that coin.
Right. Yeah. I mean, in classical theory, it's somewhat trivial if you assume that there's one sort of one measurement to rule them all, which is, gives you infinite information for zero disturbance. But
I just wasn't sure if that was what you were getting at.
Well, the argument was to try to say that if you bring the analogy back to quantum mechanics, that it's not sufficient to just ascribe ontic value to a physical system, because there's this damping process that's happening, and you ought to include that in your description. So really, I would say the quantum state is an epistemic state about the damping process. Now, given the damping process, sure, this thing is always happening, but that's not something that's in a sense. What this Zeno measurement is doing is just giving you new fresh copies of the same system. You can just take the mathematics.
What's the difference between having many independent copies and having many measurements
There is no difference. I mean, formally there.
So then, why is it? But it's supposed to be surprising somehow, and I'm missing. I'm not in the right frame of mind to make it surprising.
I see. Very good. it's not. But the idea is, like, if you take something in quantum mechanics that ought to be surprising, and then you find that the same thing is true, something similar, something looks the same in classical mechanics, is also true, then I would say immediately the surprise should go away. It shouldn't be surprising anymore because, classical theory ought to be intuitive and appeal to your intuition. So once you show that it happens in classical theory, it should be clear why. I would prefer that I had some
simple more there that I'm not getting. But I mean, suppose I just put the same bias point over and over and over again. Then that's the trivial way in which we classically get the information.
Right.
On the back. This is not that. This is supposed to be not that something. That's what I'm missing.
Well, there's a sense in which in the classical case, you could make it. You could phrase a game in which that it was equivalent to that. So in the quantum case, imagine it's a game, right? So let's go back. This is probably not the best way. So in the quantum case, what happens? You do this weak measurement, and then it gets projected back. So you can try to imagine that physically as, you know, a single system, and there's some damping process that's happening to it. Or you could rephrase that as some sort of game where, you know, I want to optimally guess the state, so I do the weak measurement, and you know, I give it to you, and you're the one doing the protecting, you're the protector. So it's this black box that you know is doing this protecting. And then once you sort of look at it that way, you see that it's just a re-preparation of the same quantum state. And then you're kind of back to the original scenario. And so you can, it's somewhat, yeah, I mean, it's, the hard thing is, you know, there's this tension between just saying that it's trivial and obvious that you would be able to do this in the classical case. But at the same time, you don't want to, you know, ask people to mentally step too far ahead. So there's some sort of tension between gradually getting there and just what it's obvious that this is just a re-preparation of the same state. In the Hamiltonian case, it's probably much different, and that's something that we haven't fully investigated yet.
So you're not claiming that the Hamiltonian case is the same as this, but you think it might in the end be the same.
You know,
is that the statement?
Josh has strong feelings about some statement. You want to say that it's identical to the second order
deferred measurement, and this will be exactly the same for a complete week.
So he wants to use the principle of deferred measurement and do the second order perturbation to show that to first order they're essentially identical. But that's something that we don't want to say is for certain true. So at least for the top point, I think I'm happy to say, you know, happy to say that I have strong conclusions about that. Showing that this effect of anomalous weak values occurs in classical theory, and it's quite easy to see why. In that case, because you're sort of you're doing something that you normally you don't see in classical statistics textbooks. You know, you'll be normalizing this observable by this weakness parameter, and you're sort of pruning your data, which is, you know, depending on what application of statistics you're using, is not something that people do or recommend doing. So the question is, you know, at least for that particular post-selection phenomena, could this be what uniquely defines quantum theory, or is this just, you know, some effect of classical statistics? And given that, you know, quantum mechanics is a statistical theory, it shouldn't be all that surprising that this happens. And the bird says thank you.
'Cause we have seen here an experiment example how we can do beautiful mathematics and completely lose the physical intuition of what's going on. So let me show you now the physical intuition of what's going on. You will see immediately why it's completely quantum effects and no classical analog, and all the classes again that you're playing here has nothing to do with physics. What we have proven in our article is we have a if we have a spin half particle which has a magnetic moment, if we measure the spin in the z direction and find either plus half or minus half, you know, the magnetic moment will be either plus mu or minus mu. Now you have this particle in space. This is time, this is position. Your particle sits here, and for a finite time, it has a magnetic moment plus mu. You go later, and you measure any point in space, the magnetic field of this produced by this particle, it will be proportional to mu. Since there are quantum fluctuations of the magnetic field, you have to repeat this experiment many times in order to find what is the average, and the average will be mu. If you start a particle with a magnetic field in the opposite direction, you make a measurement, you will find that the magnetic field average is minus mu. Now, what we have shown is that if you do a pre-selection of the spin in this direction, a post-selection of the spin in this direction, in the time in between, the particle has a magnetic moment which is 100 times bigger. You then go and measure the magnetic field everywhere later in time, there is no back reaction at all, you will find the magnetic field that is 100 times bigger than the maximum magnetic field you can get classically. Any wiggling that you do in classical particles, any kind of wiggling, any kind of disturbance, will never produce magnetic field that's 100 times bigger. What you have to do according to this game is at any point in space you have to start and bigger the magnetic field there in order to get 100 times bigger. That, and I think that's my case.
So we have questions to Chris, and I think also if anyone wants to address questions to Yaki also, then we can.
Well, I mean,
Chris, are you going to respond to that directly?
The effect that we're trying to reproduce is not this. Clearly, I mean, you know, the coin, you can just have a coin that doesn't have a magnetic moment if you like. So I'm not measuring.
You just speak a little bit louder. I can't hear you.
I can have a coin that doesn't have a magnetic moment. So I'm not interested in reproducing this the fact that you just described.
The effect of magnetic field later, never.
That's the same effect.
Yes, we agree.
What?
We agree.
So you've done it, or you believe it can be done?
I have not tried to reproduce the effect that you just described classically.
But you will never be able to do the magnetic field.
I'm not interested in doing it.
What?
I'm not interested in doing that. What I just told you was reproducing a different effect. Your argument is just moving the goalpost to somewhere new. And that's not what we've done. All I wanted to do was describe what I've done. And
but what does that have to do with the issue whether the weak value of the magnetic moment is 100 times bigger? That's what we're discussing in our article.
Is the value of magnetic moment a random variable?
Sorry?
Is the value of a magnetic moment a random variable? So, we'll have to talk about it later. Or you agree to disagree?
Magnetic moment is like a spin. If you call the spin, fine. I have the magnetic moment when the spin is positive plus sigma z is equal to plus one. I have everywhere a magnetic field which is equal to the magnetic field corresponding to a magnetic moment pointing in this direction. If the spin is minus one, I have a magnetic field everywhere in space which corresponds to minus one. This happens later in time. I have no base reaction at all. If I now, we have shown that if I pre-select the spin in that direction and post-select the spin later in that direction, in the time in between, there was a magnetic moment that was 100 times bigger, and you go everywhere in space later, you will find that magnetic field 100 times bigger. There is no classical wiggling that you can do in this magnetic moment that will produce a magnetic field that's 100 times bigger. No classical way. It comes because of interference between a positive magnetic field, negative magnetic field, that gives you by interference a result that's 100 times bigger, provided the two things are inside the quantum uncertainty of the magnetic field everywhere. In order to deal with them, you will have to measure the magnetic field everywhere in space to get that situation.
Maybe I can comment, because I think there's a sort of cultural difference that for you, you're interested in something that's classically surprising from the point of view of classical physics. You're interested in showing that this phenomenon is surprising from the point of view of classical physics, whereas he's interested in showing that the phenomenon is not surprising from the point of view of classical probability theory.
No,
so that's the cultural,
no,
the cultural
but
difference.
But I'm saying,
and I think you're both, I think.
No, it's surprising from the classical probability theory. If I have a probability of having spin up and spin down for a classical magnetic moment, it will never produce any medium, will never produce a magnetic field 100 times bigger.
But it's not the magnetic field I'm interested in. So we can both be right, because we're talking about two different problems.
Okay, so I'll report.
You can go write more stuff on the board, but it's not going
to
change the fact that we're...
I will discuss something closer to what you're interested in, to show that it's also quantum mechanics. Let's play the following game. Can I get a piece of chalk?
The magnetic field is how he is weakly measuring the intermediate spin.
Well,
that's what the magnetic moment is about. It's a way of measuring the intermediate spin. Because there's a direct link between the value of the magnetic
when he
moment
said,
and the spin.
When he said I'm abstract, when he said I'm doing math, beautiful mathematics, that was, I mean, that was near and dear to my heart. But I am abstracting all the physics away. Because you can see that we know that physical intuition is sometimes deceiving. So if we're interested in resolving these paradoxes, it behooves us to abstract as much of it away as possible. Quantum mechanics is a statistical theory, and I'm just looking at that aspect of it. I don't care about magnetic moments.
Just to try to pursue
test spaces.
The magnetic moment in his case is simply his way of making a weak measurement.
I discuss now the property of a random walk. I saw a coin. If the coin is up, I make a step delta to the right. If the coin is down, I make a step delta to the left. Okay? Now I want to discuss the same thing quantum mechanically. So my coin will be a quantum spin. If the spin is, if I find the spin sigma d up, I will move to the right. If I find the spin sigma d down, I will move to the left. So now I can start the spin sigma h equals to plus 1. Then I know that I have an amplitude of sigma j equal to plus 1 plus sigma j equal to minus 1. So I have a probability 1/2 to find the coin flip up, the coin flip down. I have a probability 1/2 to go to the right, and a probability 1/2 to go to the left. Now I have two limits. I either have the particle that is doing that, described in the classical limit by a wave packet that is very narrow, then I will find that the particle will go either this way or this way with probability 1/2. But if the particle has a wave function that is very gross compared to this, then I find that the interference of going to the right or going to the left, that interference can produce a shift in the average, which is 100 times as much. This is a quantum phenomenon of interference. You can try to reproduce this phenomena by all kinds of classical games, but there is no classical interference of quantum particles. So the property of the interference field is a quantum property. And I can show that it's a quantum property because I can do the following game, the Pigino play. I will throw a coin, and if it comes with one side, I will shift it this distance to the right. And if it comes the other side, I will shift it this distance to the right. Any wiggling would have taken the effect that the particle always moves to the right in the classical limit. But in the quantum limit, the interference of moving to the right by one step and moving to the right by another step gives you, in fact, a step in the opposite direction. This is a quantum phenomenon. It has no classical analog. You can reproduce by classical artificial games that the possibility of going with one probability to the right and another probability to the right gives you a step to the left. This is a quantum property. any classical attempt to reproduce it will be artificial. Yes, sir. The weak value is the CVP of the measurement that goes to the left. It's a completely quantum phenomenon.
Quantum walks are different than classical random walks. I agree. Should we take questions about my talk?
Yeah, more questions.
I have a question on a different topic.
Sure.
So your question you ended on, this question of, you know, is post-selection not really quantum? I mean, maybe in this narrow context, you made
sure.
a convincing case that it
right.
can be classically explained. But I think there are other cases where post-selection is maybe not explicable by a kind of
sure.
kind of
yeah. You know, rule. Yeah, I mean, as I said, my approach is to sort of process of elimination. Mm-hmm. And by eliminating as much as possible, maybe we can arrive at, you know, something that is uniquely quantum. And my opinion is that this particular form of post-selection, which gives rise to anomalous weak values, is not that.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's pretty good evidence that, in fact, there are forms of post-selection that really take you outside of some things that are explained by classical probability theory with disturbance.
Yeah, I mean, the intention of the talk is not to say there's that quantum mechanics is just classical probability theory. But it shares obviously a lot of similarities, and I think the task is to really whittle down these differences.
There are more questions, comments?
Well, I have a confusion.
we might share it.
Can I share it with you? I think it's related to what Yukio was saying, but I'm trying to trace mathematically where you're getting an outcome which is a mean outcome which is greater than what would seem to be the possible values.
The operational
it seemed to me. It seemed to me mathematical.
So one way to not get it is to not have the disturbance. If I don't have the disturbance, it doesn't happen. So
okay,
I need the disturbance, and it also has to depend.
But if you take an average of a random variable, no matter how you select, and the variable can only have two values plus or minus one, there's no way that the mean will ever be outside plus or minus one. I think it came mathematically because you divided by lambda
right.
at
yep.
some point.
Yep.
So I think the mathematical issue might be, what's the physics behind this dividing by lambda? Now, the way that people...
It's the mechanics of my arm drawing a line.
Well, there's a lot of Maxwell's equations going, because
yeah.
we had it on the screen, too.
Right.
And so on.
Probably some quantum
that's
mechanics.
that's all true, but so maybe you could say a little more about why you divided by lambda. And then,
well, the reason I divided by lambda was, in the quantum mechanical case, that's how I arrived at the weak value. To get the weak value, I divide by the weakness parameter and take the limit as it goes to zero.
Yeah, so now this
now
is
I can,
I
can
do.
I can do the measurement in the lab. It will give me a very tiny number because it's multiplied by this weak value, or this lambda parameter. So if I know what that is, then I divide by it. I have a very small number. I divide by another small number, and the outcome is the weak value.
Right, if the dividing by lambda is built into the definition of weak measurement, then it seems to me that there's no mystery at all.
Good.
The way in which it's usually described is not like that. So my confusion is
I can trace out the meter to get an equivalent description, and maybe you know this is the exact same problem that Professor Aronoff sees in this work, is that when you're looking at the wrong picture, you are led to the wrong conclusions. So we change the picture by tracing out the meter. Maybe the meter is confusing you. So let's trace out the meter, and then you see exactly how the weak values arrived at. It's this renormalization. There's something funny that it does need disturbance, but that's how you get it.
I'm more focused on the dividing by lambda. I mean, I'm a bit of an outsider to this. I've never worked on this, but... I hear people talk about weak measurements, and the impression that they give is you should focus on the meter, and you should take the meter to work. You should be looking at statistics of what the meter reads.
Well, here's what lambda corresponds to. I'll tell you. You have this meter.
That's
you have this meter that's spread out way past the eigenvalue range. Is it surprising that you would get an outcome out there? Is that surprising to you?
So the meter epistemically starts out.
Beyond the eigenvalue range. So why is it ever surprising that you would get one of those values? The only thing that's surprising is that conditional on some post-selected state, that distribution is shifted by a lot. It's some new Gaussian that's shifted over. But those values are not surprising at all because the meter is spread over all those values. It goes out to infinity. It's a Gaussian, then it has tails to infinity.
Is that right? The meter has to be a Gaussian that's very
No,
wide.
It doesn't have to be a Gaussian that has tails to infinity. But
is it true that it has to have a long tail?
Yeah.
The question is whether the meter spread is it classical probability spread or quantum amplitude? What do you think about it? Is it spread a quantum amplitude or a classical probability spread?
I can take an amplitude and I can square it. I can take an amplitude and I can square it and get a probability. So which one are you talking about?
What is the spread? The spread itself, but to imagine. Is it a quantum?
The spread is a number.
Sorry?
The spread is a number. It's a number when you do a quantum calculation on paper, it's a number.
Is it an amplitude, complex amplitude, or is it a classical probability that is everywhere policy?
Well, can we resolve this by asking
if I measure the meter directly?
Because if it's a quantum spread, I can understand how it can interfere moving this way or that way. If it's a classical probability spread, there is no interference. I claim that the weak value comes about from interference. So you have to assume that that spread you are talking about is a quantum amplitude, not a classical probability spread.
I don't follow the logic. I claim that it's an effect of interference, so I have to assume. You claim something, so I have to assume something?
No, I
don't follow that logic at all.
Look, there is a well-defined difference between classical and quantum mechanics. The difference is that in classical physics, you don't interfere probabilities, and in quantum mechanics...
That's one difference.
No, okay, but
there's lots of differences.
It's a very important difference, right? Yes?
That's what we're trying to resolve.
It's the most important difference.
No, I don't agree with that. I don't agree that it's the most important difference.
Okay, it's one important difference, right?
Sure.
Okay, I claim that the whole phenomena that we are discussing is due to the fact that you interfere moving to the right and moving to the left. That's how quantum mechanics describes that thing. Now you try to imitate that by making all kinds of games of classical disturbances. That will be equivalent. Let me just say one more sentence. Suppose somebody will come and show in the Susik experiment that you have a wave phenomena, a wave pattern of interference. Now somebody else, in fact, Bohm, has shown that it's possible to think about it classically, passing it both either in one sleep, also another sleep, and due to all kinds of strange disturbances, you reproduce the same pattern. Okay? But nevertheless, even though your image will produce the same pattern by classical disturbance, it will still be quantum mechanics because this wave pattern is connected via H bar with the momentum and all the structure has quantum features to it, even though you can reproduce it classically. So the fact that you can reproduce classically a pattern doesn't mean that it's a classical phenomenon. It's a quantum phenomenon.
So if I gave you a black box, and you shone a laser through it, and out came a pattern. If it looked like quantum mechanics, you would say there's two slits and single photons being fired at those two slits.
Yeah.
Well, I can give you a black box. That's not happening. I can give you a black box that's just a computer that has a little laser that shoots exactly where I want it, so that it builds up an interference pattern.
Right. But
so. I think that's a perfect argument against your logic.
What about is that it shows that that pattern depends on relative phase between the two lasers that you use, and that relative phase is connected with the momentum. And this connection with the momentum via H bar has no classical analog. You completely neglect this aspect of it.
All you have is data. That's all you have. You have data, and we have explanations for data. Okay, we have our experiences, comes in as data, And all the words that you're saying are just intellectual constructs to help us understand and simplify the data. If I present you with an interference pattern and your automatic reaction is that it came from a two-slit quantum mechanical experiment, then I think there's really not much more I can say. I mean, the task is to, you know, you can rephrase it. What the game on the task I'm trying to solve is, you're presented with a black box. Someone promises you quantum mechanical effects are happening. If I can show that all the observable phenomenon that comes out of that box can be reproduced by a classical theory, you know, no matter how contrived it is, then I would prefer that explanation, especially if it's some adversary.
So you say that, in fact, from your quantum mechanics is just an example of classical theory with some special disturbances.
No. I'm saying that anomalous weak values are that. I'm not saying quantum mechanics.
Okay.
I'm just saying anomalous.
I'm saying that when you speak about anomalous weak values, you're only speaking about the one aspect of it, and not the other extreme aspect, which I described.
I'm interested in that. I don't know the answer there. That's not what I was trying
to
read.
Suppose you find that there is no classical way to describe the second part. What will you say then? That it's a quantum phenomenon?
Yes.
Okay. So I challenge you now, go home and try to find out how to do this classically. And if not, you will have to write and ask the same that weak values have also properties that have no classical.
I'm going to interrupt now
because we've
already done that and it's not true. We've shown that you can get weak values. We've already done this and it's not true.
What you're
saying. We have already done this and it's not true. Can you hear me? We've shown that for a spin 1/2 particle, you can do the same calculations that Chris has done in commuting bases, and you get the anomalous weak value. That means it's a spin 1/2 particle, the weak value will be 100 times greater everywhere. It's just an effect of having weird statistics, pre and post selection, and disturbance. So you're wrong.
He could be right that, you know,
we've already done the
where they have these test particles all over that are measuring the magnetic field, and you may need to have a unique disturbance for each test particle. Maybe that's the way it turns out. I don't know, but
you'd have to disbelieve your own calculations.
Quantum mechanics tells you that magnetic field is there. You can do both measures. It's 100 times bigger without any disturbance.
Without any disturbance, yeah. I mean. So, but
okay.
you're missing one point. I don't know where this sits in your mind. But you keep saying I measure the magnetic field, but if you have a meter, right, and it tells you what the magnetic field is, it's not going to be 100 times bigger. Okay, you have to remember that the game you're playing is you have this huge data set, right, and you're pruning it. You're taking out only the pieces that you want.
I play another game that quantum mechanics allows you, and this is a game if I have n spins, because all of them are prepared in this direction, and by chance I find all of them at the end in this direction, and I have just 1 meter interacting with all of them, this meter will shoot 100 times away, and no classical reading of that meter will explain why it happened, because it's a single meter interacting with a million spin particles. There will be no way to read that the speed of meter to give you 100 times the shift.
I mean, that's, yeah. That's a claim.
Think about it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Can I make one more comment? So, my final comment is, if weak values are the answer to a question, we're asking the wrong question.
You had a question at some point. Is it still relevant? I mean, it was related to Raphael's question, but maybe it's a bit pocketful. So we'll draw this discussion to a close. Let's thank Chris and also Yakir.